The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And Happy New Year, everybody. You know, we've had an extended holiday break. I took some time off and I'm sure that most of you out there did as well. And I hope that you had a blessed holiday season. But now it's time to get back to business, and the business at hand here is the Paranormal Podcast. And today we have, well, it's a UFO show to kick off 2017. We're going to start with Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Marden about their recent book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. And couldn't be more pleased to have been able to spend some time with them towards the end of last year. And then, to keep the theme going, we're going to talk to a local man from northeastern Ohio, who I had the privilege to meet, who is a UFO experiencer. And there's even more to his story. That's Dale Harder, and he'll be joining us after Stanton and Kathleen. So I hope that you enjoy this supersized inaugural edition of the Paranormal Podcast for 2017. Enjoy. Our guests today almost need no introduction, specifically when you're talking about the topic of UFOs. I'm talking about Stanton T. Friedman and Kathleen Marden. They are the co-authors of the new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind the Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Conmen. Now, Stanton Friedman, well, he is a legend in the UFO field. He is synonymous with it. He is a nuclear physicist who worked on a wide variety of advanced classified nuclear systems for major industrial companies. He began the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident, wrote Flying Saucers and Science and Top Secret Magic, and co-authored Crasher Corona, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and Science Was Wrong. He has appeared on hundreds of radio and television programs, and he resides in New Brunswick, Canada. And by the way, I'm sure he won't remember this, but he was the second guest on this program back in August 2005. And when I listened to that episode, my ears bleed because I was horrible. Hopefully I've improved a little since then. And next up is Kathleen Marden. She's also been on the program. She's a best-selling author, award-winning UFO researcher and lecturer, and a frequent guest on radio shows. Her expert testimony has been featured on History, Discovery, National Geographic, and Destination America channels. She is co-author of Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, Science Was Wrong, and The Alien Abduction Files, and she lives in Florida. And this time of year, I'm kind of envious of that. Thank you both for joining us today on the program.
Great to be back.
I'm delighted to be here. I should add that we don't have electricity here right now.
Oh, so, my.
No, I'm okay. It's just it's kind of a shock when you wake up in the morning and no power.
Absolutely.
After 10 inches of snow, you understand.
Oh, believe me. I've been there being from the Cleveland area, so I understand.
Yes.
Well, to this book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, what was kind of the idea by this? I mean, you've both written many books. There have been many, many books written on the UFO subject. A lot of signal to noise out there. You know, you've got a lot of people writing books. Maybe some know a lot less than others, like yourselves. What was the idea behind this book?
Well, I think we should both answer that question.
Yeah.
And for me, I am very interested and have been for a long time in the history of our government's involvement in the study of UFOs, their findings despite denial, and also their reason to cover it up, and who was involved in the cover-up. So for many, many years, I've done a great deal of research on this. Somehow I got pegged as an abduction researcher, which I continue to do, but I'm much more than that. I have varied interests, and this is one of my major interests. I wanted to go to Philip Klass's archival collection. And if your listeners are not familiar with Philip Klass, he was probably the most prolific disinformation person in the media about UFOs during the 20th century. And I had a personal interest because of his many attacks upon my aunt and uncle Betty and Barney Hill. So I started there with his archival collection at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, made several trips there over many, many days, came out with probably 1,000 documents because I found more than just information about Betty and Barney. There was a gold mine of information there about his part in the cover-up and his correspondence with other individuals, some who worked for the government, who took part in the cover-up as well. And I learned that he knew the truth about most of these very prominent cases, yet distorted the information despite the fact that he had accurate information. So now I'll turn it over to Stan.
Well, before he answers, I just want to ask you one question on that. When it comes to Klass, you know, a lot of times I almost feel that what we see, at least now, a lot of times is not necessarily people in newsrooms that are being paid by the CIA or somebody, but it's just become kind of the convention to make fun of UFO stories. You're saying instead of that, in this case, Klass and others were directly instructed by people representing the government to put disinformation out. Is that correct?
We have information, absolutely, in our book that connects all of this. We were not able to find a paycheck for Philip Klass, indicating that he had definitely worked for a three-letter agency. We found information among other scientists that we wrote about in the book that they did work for these agencies. We do know, and we have the evidence in the book, that Philip Klass was the go-to guy for the mainstream media. It became part of his job. He worked a full-time job, but in addition to that, he worked nearly full-time debunking UFOs. Now, who would do that unless they had some kind of maybe government-related interest in the cover-up? And we do have information that he was communicating with people like Hector Quintanilla, who was the head of Project Blue Book from mid-1960s, 1963, until it closed at the end of 1969. So he definitely was wrapped up and involved in all of this.
Standen?
Well, an important point here is that many people today have forgotten about the Church Committee hearings of the 70s. Senator Frank Church conducted hearings which shocked a lot of people when they found that there were a number of media people who were in bed with the CIA, and to put it kindly, some with the full knowledge of their employers, Life magazine, Time magazine, those sorts of things, and others that nobody knew about. And I mention that because I talked to somebody who had worked with Phil Klass at Aviation Week and Space Technology, based in Washington, very convenient go-to man, you know, for anybody. And he told me that when it was determined that a particular writer for Aviation Week had a connection, he was fired. So if Phil had a connection with any agency, he certainly had the good sense to not admit it, to not parade it, to make nobody aware of it. My approach came from a sort of different direction. As a physicist, of course, I was interested in technology, but I also found that I had a great interest in archives. I've been to 20 different archives, some of them many times, and I like to be sure to have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. In other words, to have first-hand information when you can get it. And it is available. You got to go to it. A lot of people think everything in the world is on the Internet. Well, that isn't true. Probably my most important finding in UFO research about people connected with this part of the story anyway was that Dr. Donald Menzel, who was the leading debunker of the 50s and 60s, that he had a longer continuous connection with the National Security Agency. He told President Kennedy, mind you, in writing, and I have a copy of the letter, but you could only find it at the Harvard archives, and it took permission from three different people for me to get access to it. So what I'm getting at, I was excited about the process of getting facts, and particularly in Klass's case, when he would sound off saying, making all kinds of claims. I'm famous for showing, for showing a $1,000 check that he wrote me for MJ-12 research. And it typifies the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. I like the way that sounds. He claimed that a document that had been found at the National Archives, he hadn't been there, of course. He lives within 50 miles of the place, but don't let that get in the way. There was a document which mentioned, it was a memo from Robert Cutler to General Nathan Twining, and it mentioned NSC, National Security Council, MJ-12 Special Studies Briefing. And he pointed out, it was found by two associates of mine, we were working on Roswell stuff, he pointed out that, gee whiz, that used the wrong typeface. It should have been Pica type. And one would think that he looked at a lot of government documents of that time period. He pointed out that the NSC uses a Leet type, and he had 10 samples to prove it. And he challenged me to find any genuine documents meeting a whole bunch of criteria done in the same size and style type. And he would pay me $100 each for every such genuine document. I had 60 days. And he came across with a very strong attitude about it. You know, it was like, ha, you missed the boat, buddy, was the attitude. Well, I was going, I went to my files, and I had been to the Eisenhower Library many times, and I pulled out 20 documents done in Pica type, but they didn't all meet his criteria because you had to be signed with a certain time frame and so forth. He accepted two, and I guess he thought he had me. But I was going to the Eisenhower Library, and when I got there, I found 14. It's easy to tell the difference for people who don't know. Pica is big, Leet is small, and they use a lot of different typewriters at these places, you can imagine. And so I found 14, made copies, sent him an invoice. He set a limit of 10, unfortunately, or I'd be a wealthy man. he paid me my $1,000 and got very angry when I included a copy of the check in something I'd written, and it's in our book, too, for that matter. But the point is, I found out subsequently, he had never even been to the Eisenhower Library, and they have 250,000 pages of National Security Council material. So the notion that you can generalize from 9 or 10, let's say 10, to 250,000 is absurd. So it does raise the obvious question, why would somebody who was not an idiot, Klass was sharp, make such a silly claim, even though he had never been there? I guess he thought nobody else goes there either. And so part of my determination on this book with Kathy was that let's put the facts on the table, the firsthand information. I found somebody, I called the Truman Library and found somebody who worked with Truman the entire time he was in the White House. And he knew what was going on at the time of this document and could ask him questions. He could tell me that James Lay, the executive secretary of the National Security Council, sat right next to Bobby Cutler, who was Ike's national security advisor, at all the meetings of the council. And of course he would have written a memo in place of him because he was out of the country, Cutler. You know, it's one of those funny things. If the document had been signed, it would be a phony because Bobby Cutler was out of town at the time. The guy, his name is on it, but there's no signature and no /S/, meaning original signed by. So the need for the book was to point out the overall need for firsthand investigation, for getting facts in hand, and doing your research by investigation and not by proclamation. And so it put together a lot of stuff that nobody else has put together. There are indeed loads of books out there, most of them about particular cases, me about Roswell, Kathy about the Hills, and so forth. But this is the only book that's really tossed all the stuff about the debunkers into a pot and came up with a stew of nonsense. I mean, as an example, too, look, I'm a nuclear physicist. Dr. Edward U. Condon was a well-known physicist, admitted early to the National Academy of Sciences, had an outstanding reputation, was president of the American Physical Society. Why would Condon say some of the dumb things he said? Kathy knows one of the. Listen to this statement about aliens coming to Earth or not coming to Earth.
Well, Condon wrote in his opinion to the National Academy of Sciences, it is safe, and this is a quote, it is safe to assume that no intelligent life outside our solar system has any possibility of visiting Earth anytime in the next 10,000 years.
Well, that's stupid. Here's one of the objections I have, and maybe this is something I've heard one of you say, and I'm just recoagulating it. But I've always one of the arguments is, well, they're obviously too far away to reach us here on Earth, because it would not be possible to travel these far distances and so forth and survive. And that my question is, well, based on our science, yes, but. By definition, if they are visiting, they're much, much more advanced than we are. And we don't have, you know, those of us who don't, you know, don't have firsthand evidence, don't know what science they're operating under and what mysteries they have solved. You know, somebody in 1700 would say, well, it'd be utterly impossible to fly across the, the Atlantic. Well,
say that in 1900.
Yeah. 1927, Charles Lindbergh proved them wrong. So the point is, just because we didn't know DNA didn't exist in 1900 didn't mean it didn't exist. It existed. We just didn't have the time, tools, and technology to have it figured out yet. So I think these blanket statements, assuming the science of an alien race, are just either ignorant or intentionally misleading.
Well, remember, too, that most of these guys seem, and I'm thinking of the SETI community, for example, you know, the silly effort to investigate guys, don't know what our technology is. I worked on a study of nuclear fusion propulsion for deep space travel in 1962, which makes me feel slightly ancient, but anyway, we concluded if you wanted to spend the dough, you could go, but it would take a lot of dough. Look, Magellan set a record the first time somebody went around the planet. He didn't, but his ship did. Some natives didn't like him on the way and took him out. But it took 3 years. Wow. Today, the space station does it in 95 minutes. That's an enormous jump. But my mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. As an example of that, I worked on fission rockets. Three different organizations successfully ground-tested each a slightly different one. The biggest that was tested by Los Alamos is 1970. Here's a system less than 8 feet in diameter that operated at a power level of, would you believe, over 4,000 megawatts. Now, the power level of Hoover Dam out near Vegas is 2,000 megawatts, and it's a heck of a lot bigger than 8 feet in diameter.
And that's 1970. And another point you made, I want to go back on a little bit, because I think about this in my personal life. You know, I'm in my 40s. I'm old enough to remember card catalogs. When we went in, when I was in college, we still had to find things on the shelves, and in undergrad or grad school, you'd have to, you know, look up scholarly journals and make photocopies of them and so forth. And now everything's computerized. But in a way, there are two things here. But my point is, to your point earlier, you know, some of these documents pointing out some of these inconsistencies or maybe some of these conspiracies exist, but they'll never be found by most current day researchers because they don't even know how to research paper documents. And you know, they're used to everything being in a database.
But you could see at home.
Right. So, I mean, I think in a way, maybe we're losing our opportunity to get some of this information because researchers who are, you know, old enough to remember paper, and I'm 40s, I'm still able, but, you know, people 5 years, 10 years behind me are not. So as we go along, people who have this appreciation on how to do research outside of a computer keyboard, you know, something's being lost there.
Yes.
It will be lost, definitely. And it's so important to have the patience and to take the time and to spend the money to travel to these archival collections and to read the paper documents. And you cannot get the information in our book, a lot of the information, over a computer. It's just not there. And boy, it's what we have written is so very important for that reason.
Well, we're going to be talking more about fact, fiction, and flying saucers right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. And I know that this past holiday season, I'm sure that many of you got new devices, maybe a smartphone, a tablet, or a streaming TV device. Now the question is, what are you going to watch on it? And may I make a recommendation? I'd like to recommend Gaia. Gaia is the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. And Gaia is always providing viewers with tremendous new content, and 2017 is no exception. They're starting the new year off right with a new series called Missing Links, hosted by New York Times bestselling author Greg Braden. Now, the premise of the program is this. In order to thrive in the world emerging before our lives, we need to embrace a new way of thinking. New discoveries reveal our relationship to our ancient past and may hold the keys to the way we think about ourselves, one another, and our world. And once we bridge together the links of our mysterious past and examine new scientific findings, we may finally begin to answer the most important question of all. Who are we? Explore the deep truths of our origin, history, destiny, and fate with Missing Links. Now, I think that you will enjoy this new program. And I know you will enjoy Gaia. You've got all of your other favorites on Gaia: David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, George Norrie, and so much more. And it is a great time to join in this new year, because the first month of your membership, well, it's only 99 cents and you can cancel at any time. Maybe 2017 is the year that you want to kind of expand your intellectual horizons and you want to learn more about all of these kind of areas. Well, one great source for you is going to be Gaia. So, to mine the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's GAIA.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, it's only 99 cents. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guests are legendary UFO authors Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Marden. They have a new book out, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind the Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Conmen. Now, going back and looking at history, in your mind, to the best of your surmise, who was the first president who said, "We are going to put a clamp on that"? Was that Truman with Roswell, or was there knowledge predating that, perhaps back to FDR? Who made the decision that this is not going to be exposed to the public? We are not going to let this out, and this is going to be kept a very tight lid on?
Well, I vote for Truman simply because of Roswell. There were bodies. There was wreckage. These were clearly not from here. The behavior within a period, within 2 weeks before the Roswell incident, there'd been over 1,000 sightings. Kenneth Arnold's famous sighting was June 24th, and Roswell was the first week in July. So there was a lot going on in a lot of places. But there had been interest before that with Curiosity. James Doolittle, General James Doolittle, was asked to talk to the Swedish Defense Department because of those flying saucers that were seen in Sweden. And nobody's ever seen a report that he wrote about that. And when I found out that he was still alive many years ago, but he was an old man by then, and I told Bill Moore, lived in California, who went to see him. Jimmy Doolittle's kind of a hero. You know, he led the raid over Tokyo. He did all kinds of things, one of the world's great flyers and stuff like that. But he had very selective memory about what he did when he was in Sweden, about his discussions with the Swedes about the they didn't call them saucers, but close to that. That was somehow something he didn't recall. As an example of other things that he did, Ike asked him, he knew Ike from the war, of course. Ike was running the show, and Jimmy was running one of the Air Force groups. Ike asked him to do an overview of the CIA, would you believe? And he did it. Whatever the boss wants, the boss gets, he said. He was a vice president of Shell Oil, Jimmy Doolittle was. He was clearly trusted at the highest levels as somebody who would tell it like it is, and presidents need that. So I believe Truman was the one who got it going. Roosevelt had a war to run and was more concerned. And for people who think you can't keep secrets, Truman's a good example. When he was elected vice president of the United States, he wasn't told anything at all about the Manhattan Project to develop nuclear weapons. 13 days after Roosevelt was died, he was briefed by General Marshall about the Manhattan Project, and he had to decide within a few months whether to drop the bombs on Japan or not. But that's an example of, you know, keeping secrets. You don't tell everybody who doesn't have a need to know and an appropriate clearance. And there are many other examples. Lockheed developed the stealth aircraft, spent $10 billion in secret to do that. The Manhattan Project that I mentioned, you had to separate uranium isotopes. So we built a facility near Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a mile long, mind you, to pump, and this is in the middle of the war, to pump uranium through little holes in nickel barriers, because U-235, the one you want, moves a little faster than U-238, the heavier atom. And you got to do this several times. That facility not only was a mile long, but was using 5% of all the electrical power being produced in the United States. And during the war, electrical power was at a premium because you got to make tanks and ships and planes and, you know, all that stuff. But that's keeping a secret pretty darn well, I'd say. And I say this because sometimes the ancient academics and fossilized physicists, as I call them when I'm being polite, seem to think, hey, you can't get here from there, because they assume today's technology or yesterday's technology, and B, that governments can't keep secrets. In one of my recent papers, a column for the MUFON Journal, they started off with the assumption, well, with the internet and YouTube, you can't keep any secrets. Everything's out there in the open. Well, you don't publish classified material. I had a clearance for 14 years, and the professor who made that statement obviously didn't know what he was talking about. So we like, Kathy and I like to get down to the facts and the data. And we found out, Kathy found out that there was a kind of a what do I call it, a correlation between the views of Condon and Class and Menzel. And when I had one run-in with Menzel, I was giving a lecture at Harvard and called early in the day to invite him to my lecture because I didn't know whether, because it was for an engineering alumni group, whether it was going to be open to the public or not. And we had never had any contact, as far as I knew anyway. And I gave him my name. Oh, I know all about you. You saw my congressional testimony next to yours? No, you can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers, he said, at which case I laughed and he got angry. Stupid thing to say. So I mollified him, said, look, I didn't call to argue with you, just called out of courtesy to invite you to my lecture tonight at 8 o'clock at such and such hall. Oh, well, of course I won't be there. So I told the story that night. But so I didn't like Menzel. And it illustrated, though, the willingness of these guys to keep their secrets. And I didn't know what he meant, and I was curious. He knows all about me. What does that mean? Well, Kathy provided the solution, didn't she, Kathy?
Yes, I did. I found it at the American Philosophical Society. And what happened is that Condon had sent information to Menzel with regard to Stan. And you can fill in on that, Stan.
Yeah, I had sent some letters to Condon, and I was not happy with his unscientific approach, as you might imagine. I mean, according to the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, 30% of the sightings that were looked at by Condon's people could not be identified. 30%! my goodness, all kinds of phenomena. Fewer than 30% of the times a good baseball player goes to bat does he get a hit after all. You know? So that was kind of a shock to find that Condon had sent stuff on to Menzel, that which I hadn't known about. But that's what happens. These guys get together. And look, Menzel was recommending Class to somebody too, wasn't he, Kathy?
Menzel was recommending Class.
Condon
recommended Class to the head of McGraw-Hill Publishing Company, that Class should be the spokesman, the mainstream spokesman with regard to UFOs, because he was so highly knowledgeable on the subject, and that Dr. James McDonald, who most of us know as probably the greatest scientist who ever lived. He was a full professor at the University of Arizona, a meteorological physicist, had been chairman of the department, became co-chair when he began his study of UFOs. Well, they said that he didn't know much about the topic, that Phil Class would correct the foibles of people like Professor James McDonald, which is absolutely ridiculous. Anyone who knows anything about this topic knows that it was Philip Class who was the disinformant, and that James McDonald was the scientist studying all of this. Yet, this has been carried down through the mainstream media for years and years. And I want to mention something that I found at the American Philosophical Society about Stanton Friedman. When I went there, Stan asked me to look for Class's Friedman file. Now, I looked and I discovered that there were extensive files on many other researchers who had written, corresponded with Philip Class. Yet, there was no Friedman file at the American Philosophical Society, although they had written to each other for, 20 or 30 years, Stan?
20 years, yeah.
20 years. There was copious information, and Stanton has given me many of the letters that and the correspondence that they had to each other. But I think that Class had met his match with Stanton Friedman. So what Class did is he stacked the deck against Stan to give a distorted point of view for anyone who ever went to his archival collection to do research there. The information about Stanton is absolutely false, but Class, in a sense, slandered Stanton in his correspondence with others and in his archival records.
And look what he said about J. Allen Hynek, the FBI file. Anybody can get it. I think they still can get it through the internet. Hynek had written a letter, had published an article in an FBI journal saying, here's a place where the Center for UFO Studies where you can report your sightings, and it'll take some of the pressure off the FBI of investigating UFO sightings. They got killers to worry about and so forth. And Class was really nasty to the FBI about J. Allen Hynek. He's not a scientist. And
he said that he, quote, is the spiritual leader of the vocal group of believers and kooks who claim that we are being visited by extraterrestrial spaceships. He said the FBI has given its endorsement to a hoax that UFOs are of extraterrestrial origin and to a fraud, Dr. Allen Hynek. But
the FBI, to its credit, responded, didn't they, Kathy?
Yes, they did. And they said that Class was informed that Hynek is a highly respected scientist recognized by all creditable professionals in his field of expertise, who is affiliated with a leading university, and that Class's attempts to discredit Hynek are totally without foundation. Hynek could scarcely have better scientific credentials, all of his writings and public statements that were examined prior to his publication, disclose a meticulously objective and scientific view of the UFO phenomenon. And what Phil Klass did is he responded by saying he won't be for long. And I found evidence in Klass's files that he had a little spy at Northwestern University, where Hynek was the head of the astronomy department, who was spying on Hynek and reporting back to Klass with any damaging information or any information he could find that Klass could use to damage Hynek, to try to destroy not only the man, but his career.
The interesting thing to me about all of this is if there was nothing to the UFO notion, if it was a hoax, if it wasn't true, why would the powers that be spend so much time, effort, and ostensibly money on trying to smear those who are proponent of there being something about it?
Good question. He also wrote a strong letter to Canada warning them that snake oil salesman Friedman is going to be moving to Canada. I moved in 1980. And I didn't know about this letter, of course, until Richard Dolan found it many years later and commented to me thinking that I did know about it, and I didn't. But again, you have to say, a senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology, what is it, why is it his business to write nasty letters about me to Canadian government officials? I mean, that's beyond the call of duty, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that seems absolutely insane. Now, I want to talk about, because I know we're short on time here, but I want to talk about a couple more categories of the cover-ups and so forth. One that I think is interesting, because I think when most people hear of hoaxers, they just think that it's maybe people who are in it for fame or a quick buck. But is there a piece of this where actually hoaxers are disinformation officers, essentially, for the powers that be? Is that a part of the picture as well?
I believe so, and I'm going to let Stan speak. But whenever it seems, and let me talk about what's happening today, when information is disclosed, oftentimes there is other information that is put out, a great deal of information, such as the MJ-12 papers, and Stan can address that. But you have real documents, and then you have documents that are disseminated that are not real. And we have case after case of this occurring. And when true information is disseminated today, we have information that calls the other information into question. So go ahead, Stan.
Well, yeah, MJ-12 is a good example. I think there are four genuine documents and dozens of phony ones. And somebody asked me, well, how did they do that? And I think the Air Force Office of Special Investigation must have had some students in their classes given assignments, make up a phony document. Because I feel you have to deal with archives, as I said before. And in one case, one of these documents mentioned a general, Wiedemeyer, who supposedly was part of this MJ-12 thing. And I knew him as a China expert, so I called the Marshall Archives. He worked closely with General George Marshall and said, can you see any reason why Wiedemeyer would be part of such activity? I can't find it. And he said, no. Why don't you read his book? Oh, I didn't know I'd written one, so he gave me the title. I called the University of New Brunswick Library, which is 2 miles from my house, and they had a copy. I went over and got it, brought it home, and in half hour, I found three documents that had clearly been emulated, slight changes to make them look genuine, when in fact they were phony. So I found the modus operandi, if you will, of some hoaxer somewhere. And I went back to that same part of the library and found another book and found a couple of more. So I was getting a handle on how they did this. But obviously it was important to somebody to put out baloney and to get people to say, well, this is phony, so they're all phony, you know, that sort of thing. And so the hoax is a two-edged sword. Yes, it can be somebody who's making a claim that's totally untrue about his great adventures on his way to Venus and stuff like that. And there were a bunch of those, the contactees early on. And on the other hand, there is what I would call official hoaxism, if you will. People need to understand that, you know, there is confidential documentation, there is secret documentation, there is top secret documentation, there is top secret code word. And in top secret code word, information cannot be put in secret documents. And so we talk about some of that in the book, that there was a study done for the CIA, the Robertson panel, but it's only secret. So if those guys knew anything, they surely couldn't say it. And General Twining, a letter from him that was secret, said how much they'd like to have pieces of wreckages if they didn't have any. Well, there's no question that a crashed saucer and alien bodies would be top secret code word information. And so you have to be very careful. Sometimes it's not a hoax, it's just not the truth, because they can't tell the truth. So you got to be always cautious about information, but go to firsthand sources. For example, there's 12 people at MJ-12. I talked to families of all but one of them to get a handle on whether they'd been told anything and so forth. And I get people telling me, well, all those guys in MJ-12 would certainly have told their wives what they were doing. And I had to say, absolutely not. I never told my wife anything classified. It would be against the law in the first place because I'd signed a paper and so forth. But it would be stupid. I can't control what my wife says or where she says it. And you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. There are spies out there. I mean, that may surprise some people.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like if you don't want a secret out, don't tell anybody. I mean, if you tell anybody, it's bound to get out. It's just common sense. That's amazing to me. I want to quickly ask you, the media. You know, I mentioned before, I firmly believe now, without any training or any, it's not necessarily in a manual, that the way, for example, on local news to cover a UFO story is you gotta put it towards the end of the show. Usually, maybe it's the kicker story, as they call it. You've got to have the snarky anchor with the raised eyebrow, and of course you have to have the X-Files music, and it's just a convention. It's that there's a way to cover a fire, there's a way to cover a robbery, there's a way to cover an election, there's a way to cover a UFO story, and that's just the accepted way to do it now.
There's a PhD thesis about press coverage of UFOs.
Oh, interesting.
Has some strong comments about the inadequacy of the.
Yeah, it's horrible.
All these scientists, nobody talks about the PhD thesis. You'd think that'd be the first place to go, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
For a professor, you know?
Yeah, well, it's horrible. But my question is that how much of it is, as I believe, it's become like the way to do it. It's just ingrained. Somebody comes in new in the newsroom. Hey, kid, this is how we do it. And how much of it is somebody writing a memo and say, you will cover it this way? Or maybe that's the way it started, and then it's just kind of evolved into it being the convention. Huh? What do you think?
Boy, it's difficult to know that for sure, but it seems that Philip Klass and the others who were working with him were very, very successful in shaping the media's attitude toward all of this. I was recently interviewed at the MUFON Symposium, where I spoke in August, and just received the film strip from that. And what I discovered is that the television interviewer was going around for, this is JAX News out of Jacksonville, Florida, asking the speakers at the symposium if they were Star Wars fans, if they were science fiction fans, using the words Nanu, Nanu, and acting just really in a way that he should be embarrassed about. I did an interview about Betty and Barney Hill. And what I found is what they showed was a extremely edited version of it, where they left out the evidence, they left out who Betty and Barney were, they left out the close encounter with a silent, hovering, disc-shaped craft. They left all of that out and gave a very tiny amount of what I said, highly edited, and then talked about this was what makes skeptics cringe.
Right. They can make anybody look like an idiot. I mean, they edit it and they add spooky music. And I mean, you could say something extremely seriously and they can make you look like an absolute idiot. And that's why I think many people don't want to do interviews with the general media anymore, because they know that they're going to be framed as a nut job. And it's unfortunate. Well, I guess two last things, because I know you've got other things to do today and we appreciate your time. But, and this is kind of two questions wrapped in one. I can kind of understand why the government would have covered this up in 1948, for example. You're just coming out of an extremely traumatic world war. You're faced with the new reality of the atom bomb at that time and possible destruction. There's paranoia about the Soviets, and I think a lot of that was actually warranted. So I can understand why the government says, the last thing we need to do is tell people everything they've ever learned in their life is wrong and there are aliens and we have proof. I can understand that in 1948, but why do we still have to have that position in 2016?
Well, remember the national security implications. If you've got a crash saucer wreckage, in other words, and you've got alien bodies, it may give you enough information to be one up on your enemies. And that's very important. You don't share information about your latest technology. Also, funny thing to say about government, but, you know, people in power don't like to give up power. We live on a planet where nationalism is the only game in town. And so there are a lot of guys with, I don't know how many nations are there, 198, something like that. A lot of guys with power. To start thinking of yourselves as an earthling would mean you'd lose your special power.
Interesting.
And I don't know people who like to give up power. Also, there's a religious side of this thing. Who speaks for the planet? Did Jesus die to save them? The Pope has been more open, the Pope's people, and have been much more open about, well, if they were asked, they would baptize an alien. And there's no reason to say that the same God who made us didn't make them. That is a different viewpoint from the fundamentalists who are saying that we are the only intelligent life in the universe, mind you, when all the sensible communicating people are here on planet Earth, and this UFO stuff is the work of the devil, which is pretty far outreaching, if you will. So, of course, neither one of us speak for the government, and they may know that there's something going to happen in 18 years and we're all going to be wiped out and there's no point in telling anybody that because there's nothing we can do about it. Who knows? But one thing that's changed drastically, which I'm glad of, we've come to realize that the notion of our being significant, important, alone, et cetera, goes down the tube. According to the Kepler spacecraft, of which I am a great admirer, there's between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. That means within 100 light years of here, which is just down the street, the galaxy's 100,000 light years across, just 100 light years of here, there's 10,000 stars. That means 10,000 planets. And the universe has been around 13 billion years or so. So there's no indication at all that we're the oldest, the most important, et cetera, et cetera. So I would turn the coin around and say, hey, of course aliens are paying attention to us. We have exploded fusion devices. Everybody's going to want to find out how their star works, and fusion is the way it goes. We're a threat to them. You know, a fusion bomb, the biggest one, released the energy of 57 million tons of TNT. One stinking bomb, 57 million tons. So anybody would know that you can use fusion to go to the stars. And if I were an alien, I wouldn't want us out there. We're not nice guys. We killed 50 million people during the Second World War. We destroyed 1,700 cities. Would any respectable alien want us taking our brand of friendship, which everybody else calls hostility, out there? I don't think so.
Yeah, I can understand that.
You know, it's a toughie. Where do we go from here? And Ike warned about the military-industrial complex, but that is part of a picture here. How can a planet like ours spend $1 trillion a year on things military when there are starving kids all over the place? You know, from the outside, we don't look too sharp, do we?
Good point, good point. One last question, and then I certainly want to tell people where folks can find the book, because really there's a lot to delve into. If you're interested at all in UFOs, you should have this book. Both of you have kind of seen it all, written a ton on this. I mean, spent the majority of your professional lives looking into all this, or a huge portion of, I should say, of your professional lives looking into this. Was there anything that surprised you that came out of the research for this book? Something that said, wow, I didn't expect that.
I can say that there was for me, and that is that I found evidence of the link between the various individuals who were working on the cover-up, a link between Menzel and Klass, between Condon and Klass, between all of them and Carl Sagan, and so on and so forth. I did not realize that they were all working in concert with one another.
Sagan's interesting, by the way. There's just a new book out on that, too, and we'll have an interview on that as well soon. But anyway, go ahead, Stanton.
Well, one of the biggest things that surprised me happened not very long ago when John Brandenburg, Dr. John Brandenburg, a physicist, concluded and published a paper in a peer-reviewed location saying that there were two H-bombs exploded on Mars in the past, based on the isotope ratios. This is over a million years ago. Now, that came as, wow, somebody, and it wasn't us, was exploding H-bombs. Now, I like fusion because it's what powers the universe. So I think everybody's going to find out about, we didn't find out it was fusion until 1938 that powers the sun. Just a mass of burning gas. Sorry, no, it's not. So that came as a real surprise to me that there might have been. But it's the final nail in the coffin of we're it. We're the only ones. You know, ain't nobody else out there, man. That came as a shock. Also, I guess as a physicist, I do get disturbed when I see so many professional people saying so many stupid things about UFOs, aliens, space travel, government cover-ups, stuff like that. My rule is have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. I guess a lot of people don't follow the rule. So I was disappointed in that. I was an idealist when I started. I'm not an idealist anymore.
Well, it is a fascinating discussion, a fascinating book. Where can folks find the book and more information on everything that you both do?
Well, I'll begin with that. My website for autographed copies of our books is Kathleen-Marden, that's MARDEN.com. All of our books are also available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble, in any bookstores, but on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, you can purchase an audiobook,
An ebook,
thanks, Dan, and the hard copy of our book as well, depending upon which you prefer.
And my address, my website is, which lists the books, all my books, is www.stantonfriedman.com, and it lists the books. And as Kathy said, from us you get autographs. Both of us have autographed book plates. We don't ship books back and forth to sign your name on them. But as both our autographs, you can't get that on Amazon. You can get the book on Amazon.
Very neat. Thank you both so much for being a part of the program today, and continued success.
Thank you. Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Always a delight to get to speak to two legendary people in the UFO field, Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Marden. Next up is Dale Harder. He is a UFO experiencer from the Cleveland, Ohio area, and I think you'll be fascinated by his story, and here it is. Our guest today is an interesting gentleman, actually someone I had an opportunity to meet. I was lucky enough to go speak to one of the local groups here, the North Coast InfoQuest group, and talk about my campfire books and my podcast. They're very kind to invite me. And I met a gentleman there who has a very interesting background. He was with NASA. He's a UFO researcher. And there's even more to his story that he's going to talk to us about today. I'm talking about Dale Harder, and he joins us on the line, and he's going to tell us about his experience with UFOs and take us a little deeper into his experience and some things that he thinks maybe we should know. Dale, welcome to the program today.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I don't know a great deal about your story, so I'll be discovering as we go along here. So let's just start. When did this all start for you? You know, some people come upon this later in life. Maybe they have an experience in their 20s, 30s, or 40s. Some people right out of the gate, very young, have an experience. How did this all start for Dale Harder?
Well, it actually all began, I guess, when I was born. I was found on a doorstep at the age of 3 months, so I was told, and I was adopted. And I was taken in by some wonderful parents who wanted children but couldn't have any. So at that particular point, which started an unusual entry, it wasn't long until I began to realize that I was having feelings and remembrances and memories and things that were unusual, to say the least. So by the time I was 4 years of age, many things were different, and I guess I was under the delusion that I was very much like everyone else, and it turned out that I was not, and we'll elaborate on that a little bit as we go. Most of the things that I can recall began around the age of six, when I built, between the age of six and seven, when I built my first laser, just after they were discovered in 1960, so this was 61. And, you know, it went from there. I guess a six-year-old repairing all the appliances of everybody in the neighborhood was a little unusual in itself.
So you had this feeling maybe you were a little bit different. You showed this early propensity for mechanics. Now, when you say you built a laser, I mean, that's a pretty, at like an elementary school age. Kind of describe that for us, because that might raise some eyebrows. People say, oh, you built a laser when you were of elementary school age. Explain to us how that worked.
Showing these different abilities and so forth, I was always interested in science and the stars and crystals and electronics and you name it. I was into it. And so my father, being an engineer for Terex, General Motors Corporation, kind of nurtured that. And so he helped me by obtaining a ruby boule, which was grown by Union Carbide. And I obtained that ruby boule, and then I ground it into a rod, which looked very much like a cigarette, a quarter inch in diameter and 2 inches long. I then fashioned a flash tube, which is the same kind of thing that is used in cameras and so forth, but a little more powerful, and assembled the whole thing, and believe it or not, a heavy toilet paper tube, and built a power supply for it. And when the tube would flash, the ruby would release a pulse of coherent red laser light. And this was based on the original made in May 16th of 1960 by Theodore Maiman. And actually, my inspiration for that came from the front page of National Geographic magazine in that year for that discovery.
So as this progressed, you got the sense that you were different. When did things even go deeper? In other words, was there like another turning point in your younger years? Was there a UFO sighting or a UFO experience, or was there something that came next?
I always had the ability. Now it's called empathic. I am empathic. I'm able to feel the energy and the thoughts and feelings of other people. I had the ability to induce or to help healing mentally and physically. I was sensitive to light and temperature. I was very much attracted to crystals. I had a lower body temperature than most people, typically at 97, and having maybe an extra vertebrae in my back and so forth. Those were some of the physical characteristics. The others was, imagine that you are this age, 6 years of age, and realize that you know a great deal of things. I came in with a mind that was wide open. I was fully programmed, if you will. I knew a great deal of things, but I didn't know how I knew them or why. And at that time, I didn't understand, as I do now, that I literally knew all the things that I know now, but I had to go through the experiences here to understand what they were. And so having a head full of knowledge like that at an early age was something that was sometimes daunting and difficult to deal with. So other children were a little bit scared of me. Actually, they were frightened to death of me. They wouldn't play with me. They wouldn't talk to me. And as a consequence, I stayed by myself and read books and enjoyed a great deal of school and loved schooling, in fact. And so I was considered a teacher's pet because I didn't want to go outside and play with the others. I wanted to learn. I wanted to read. I wanted to write and do things like that. So that was the very beginnings of some understanding.
I want to get to what you think is behind all this, but I want to find out. Now, you talked about when we met, you mentioned you work for NASA. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, being a UFO experiencer, having this kind of different childhood and background, that you happened to work for NASA. Was that happenstance? Was it luck? Do you think it was ordained somehow? Or did you self-select it? Did you say, I want to work for NASA?
Well, as you know, it was probably a great number of children's dreams at that point in the 60s and 70s to become an astronaut. As happenstance, were luck, probably a little of both, and maybe self-ordained. One of our neighbors and close friends of my parents happened to work for NASA, and this gentleman saw my interest in rockets and the stars and space, and nurtured that by always bringing me the latest of the NASA newspapers, the patches from the missions, books, magazines, pictures that were for the public, so they were beautiful, large color prints and pictures from space and so forth and so on. So it was a wonderful beginning. And he has since passed, I still think of him fondly. In fact, even had the chance to know him when I was at NASA. He was leaving at that time. So I began to work for NASA in the early part of the year of 1980.
When did the realization come that there was something very specific behind all of this in terms of feeling different, having this aptitude at a very young age and knowledge and so forth? When did you kind of have an epiphany of the fact there was something bigger behind it and what that something might have been?
Well, I always had memories of being from another place. I always had memories of life before life, if you will. But it was difficult to discuss that with anyone. In fact, I kept most of that to myself. And so I guess the best way to reveal what those memories and things were is after we get to the point where we find out more about who I am. I'll elaborate on that a little bit. But say at the age of 8, I can recall being out in the yard, and one of the chores that was assigned to us children, besides washing dishes, taking out trash, those were back in the days when children received allowances like 50 cents a week, you know. But my parents were good on that kind of thing, to teach us duties and respect and so forth. So I was out in the backyard working on trying to cut the grass. And if you can recall, I don't know that most people would remember, but they used to make what they called a rotary lawnmower. Had that.
Oh, I remember them, yeah.
Yes, had the spiral blade and so forth. So we had two. One was large, had been modified, had a motor on it, and one was small, and I could handle the smaller one. So I was out in the yard pushing that thing. It was on a beautiful, bright, sunny day, blue sky, not a cloud anywhere in the sky. So I'm out here pushing this thing, and all of a sudden I had a funny feeling, and I didn't know exactly what this feeling was, but I began to look around, and then so I looked up. And above me, in a triangular shape, an equilateral triangle, were three silver discs. And they weren't very high up, and they just kind of sat there. And as I moved, they would move. I stopped, they would stop. But they sat right above me, and I just looked at them. I was amazed, but I wasn't frightened in any way, shape, or form. And I didn't think that much of it, and I just went on and continued to pushing the mower and doing what I was doing. And eventually, they slowly just disappeared. But that was one of the first that I recall seeing the UFOs at a very early age. I believe that I had other visitations earlier, but I used to think of them as like friends and things like that, you know, when I was younger, and I really hadn't put it all together at that point. But I guess because I knew what I knew without fully understanding it, it was partly why I wasn't frightened. So these kind of things began to happen throughout my life. And people would come to me and tell me from a very early age, they would literally just walk up to me and look at me and say, "You're different. You're not from here. You can't be." They just didn't understand, but they knew something was unusual. And so it continues even to this day.
So I think now is maybe an appropriate time to kind of get to the point of what you think you, in your words, I think, what you are. You've had these UFO experiences. You've ended up working with NASA, which is serendipitous to say the least. You've had this great technical ability at a young age. You've had this knowledge. So what's going on here? What do you think's behind it? And who do you think you really are?
Well, to push right into that, not only did I work for NASA, I also worked for Honeywell Aerospace for quite a number of years, of course, in the Aircraft and Space Department. And I also opened at an early age my own company called H&H Research, in which I designed and built and refurbished gas lasers all over the world, which I still own to this day. In fact, it's still an operating company. So that's well into 45 years on that. And then opening another company after that. So I have two companies presently. Anyway, the idea that I was different and everything, having sought out other people with some knowledge, if people walk up to you long enough and begin to tell you that you're different, that you're not from here or something is unusual, and you know this in your own heart, you know it from your memories, from your feelings, with every fiber of your being, you know, you might say, "Oh, okay, yeah, sure." And basically that's what I would do, and I would shrug it off. Well, I've been on this planet 61 years, and it's taken 56 years of that time to realize that I am an ET. And I know that's a big shock, but the fact is that I remember where I came from and who I am and why I was sent. So essentially, if you'll go back to that beginning when I said I knew I was different, I have memories of coming from another place. And probably the most vivid memories that I have were just before I came here. I remember volunteering to come to Earth to help humanity to reach a higher stage of evolution. And in so doing, you know, volunteered and went through a training program and all that kind of thing. And at the very last moment, I'm on the craft, we're here at Earth, and I changed my mind. And I was frightened, and I said, no, I can't go. And they're pushing me literally out the door saying, "No, you can't change your mind." So I remember this distinctly. And so eventually I got off the craft and started. I am what they call one of the first wave, which was, in the last 60 years, was sent here to literally get the word out about other life in the universe, to talk to people, to be a candle, if you will. Some would like to say a beacon, I would like to say, but to literally reach other people and tell them, hey, you know, there's a whole lot more going on than you realize. And to do that has been a lifelong pursuit. And it's been long, it's been difficult. And even for me to accept, it was difficult. But like I said, it is a very, very unusual thing. Now that I have fully accepted that and am able to tell people about it, and I know where I came from, and I came from the Pleiades. And the Pleiades are the seven sisters constellation, as most people know, which is right in front of Orion. So it's actually visible in the night sky now. It's a beautiful star cluster. Anyway, so that's how I came to know that. In our later days, now, these days, craft come to visit me quite often. Both physical and plasma or light-based craft come to our home quite a bit. And I do belong to the Cleveland Ufology Project, which is the oldest UFO organization in the world. It's world known. And I am one of the original members. I've been in it 42 years. I was taken under the wing of Earl Neff, who was the founder. So this club was founded in 1950. It's a very serious UFO organization. And so most of the people out there in the UFO field, including the guests that you've previously interviewed, are either friends or personal contacts. And so we have all been working in that field to bring the truth out.
Yeah, I had seen Peter Robbins speak at one of your events out at the Bomb Group one time. So that was really fun. Yeah, he's great. And he's been a guest on the programs before. He's always great to work with. So, I mean, I have to say this. It's got to be very, and maybe it's not, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like it would be a very hard thing to do to come out with this information, because you're going to have people out there, and I'm sure you know this and you probably heard it. Oh, yeah, he's from, you know, the planet X or whatever it is, you know, and kind of be kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of snarky about it and kind of doubting your work. So it's got to be hard. It's got to be hard to come out with something like this. Why have you decided to just make it known?
Well, truth is always the best avenue as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think that it is also part of disclosure, as you and a great number of people out there are now aware. We're working very, very hard to have disclosure so that the government and others come forward and tell the truth about UFOs and what we believe may be withheld or suppressed information. It is part of the place that humanity is in right now, in which we all are changing. We're raising in frequency and vibration all the time. And people say, well, they don't believe that, or, you know, that's hard to swallow. But the physical evidence is around us everywhere. All the changes in the planet, the changes in the weather, the increase in temperature. In fact, there has been an increase in temperature in every planet in our solar system, including the sun. And we are also moving into a new area of space where the Alcyone sun, the main sun in the Pleiades, Alcyone, is emitting photonic energy that is influencing our sun and our solar system. And as such, Gaia, Mother Earth, is literally moving into the fourth and fifth dimensional frequency vibrational realms. So people have a hard time with that. But it's pretty much kind of, if you have a hard time with frequency or vibration, the simplest thing is to imagine water in its normal state and then heating it where it becomes steam and it changes state. So that is because the molecules are vibrating faster. So a raising in frequency is what is happening on this planet. And that means human consciousness is growing and expanding. And there's a great number of people involved in that project, such as Rebecca Hardcastle and Exoconsciousness. So I felt that it was necessary to acknowledge who I am. Why should I hide it any longer? It took me a long time to believe it. But I do have one great story, one great sighting that I would like to pass on to people. And you know, a great number of people, personal friends and otherwise, those who know me know without a doubt that I am for real. Took them a long time to figure it out or to accept it, but they really understand it now. But one story quickly is not too long ago, about a month back, one of my close friends was with me, and we went to a gem show. We were invited by a couple of our members at the UFO Club who are also gemologists. And so we went to the gem show and did our looking around and so forth. And one of our members, who is also extremely well known in the UFO field by the name of Richard Lee, invited us to come. And when we got there, we greeted him and his wife, Kathy. And he said to me, Dale, he said, there is someone here you need to meet. His name is David. He's about two aisles down and turn to the left, and he's around that corner. Okay, well, my friend George and I decided to go down there and meet this gentleman. And as we walked around this corner, probably 30 feet away, there was a fellow who had a couple of clients in front of him, and he was talking and working, you know, obviously selling gems and things. And he stopped dead and looked straight at me and put his arm out and pointed like the movie, you. But he just said, you are not from here. And just like that, in the middle of the crowd, and George, his eyes widened, and I said, oh. And as I approached, he says, I'm David. And he says, you are an ET. And he knew who I was and where I was from. And we began to develop a friendship, which continues to this day. So things like that happen very, very regular for me. Now I can accept that. Before, I would have simply said, oh, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. But without a doubt, it kind of floored my friend, and but it was really not a surprise to me. But there are people who are adept and who are very intuitive and know these things. And so if you can imagine living an entire lifetime with this happening at least once a month or more, then you got to understand how I have arrived where I am.
Now, I guess an appropriate question would be, where do you want to take it from here? I mean, what do you want to do? Are you thinking about a book, or are you thinking to get the word out? And what do you want to achieve by getting the word out? I guess the question in a way is, what was the goal when you were sent here? What was the goal, and how do you want to try to fulfill that goal?
Even that has been slightly elusive for me, and has been one of the things I have requested from my people. You know, I have an ongoing mission, and I don't even fully know what the extent of that mission is, so I've been requesting, you know, that information. And now, while the ships do come and make themselves seen, and I get telepathic responses, they speak to me directly, and they call me by name, which is very strange, to say the least. So it's like having a voice in your head. It can be male, it can be female, and it happens quite regularly. We have orbs that pass in and out of our house. So it's it's a veritable cornucopia of UFO events. And, you know, I've invited many, many people here to see the stuff. My wife, while she believes there is life in the universe, these kind of things don't bother her too much. She's quite zen about everything. I believe, in fact, if my people landed in their craft in the backyard and came to the door and she answered, she'd say, oh, yeah, just a minute, I'll get Dale. You know, nothing affect her in the least. So it's not unusual. But I am working for a personal and physical meeting with my people to as a family reunion, so to speak. I would like to know more about what it is they are expecting of me. I have some ideas, but I don't have all the answers. The only thing I can do at this point is to help people to understand, to keep looking up, and believe me, they are there. They're being seen in great, great numbers these days. And that leads me into one story I would like to relate, which is probably one of the nicest that I've had in a while. I had been out. I go out quite often to look for the craft, and I do so at night. Later it is better than earlier, because we live in an area where the aircraft are very prevalent from Cleveland Hopkins Airport. So during the later hours of the morning, the airport essentially quiets down or shuts down for a couple of hours, and there are no aircraft in the sky. So I had been out on a Saturday night. Well, it was actually August 20th. On the 19th, which was Friday, was my wife and our anniversary. It was our 11th year together, 10 years here. She's from China. And so 10 years here and 1 year together in China. Anyway, we had decided we were going to go to dinner. And she was unavailable until Sunday to do so. So we put that off until Sunday. So on Saturday night, as I said, I was outside and I was looking and talking to my folks, and they would do their usual tricks. The ships would appear and they'd do the flash bulb thing, as we call it, out of dark space, no stars or anything. What you get is a very, very intense single point flash, like a camera flash. And they can do this many times, and I use some laser pointers to talk with them or flash back and forth. And they will respond quite readily to this, you know, so I'll send a message, and then they'll flash back two or three times in response. And then other times they'll make themselves visible, and you can see them moving across the sky. So I asked them to come. I said, you know, flash bulbs are great, guys, but I really need some physical craft. I need you to come down and let's get together. So the very next day on Sunday, it was 5:45 in the afternoon, actually. We have a clock right by the door as we go out our side door. And we were stepping out the door. My wife went down the first two stairs, and she's on the driveway by the car. And I'm coming out the door, shutting it behind me, and I got the feeling that they were here. And I looked at my wife, and I said, "They're here." And she said, "What?" I said, "They're here." Well, I looked up between the houses, between my house and our neighbor, looking due east, straight up. The sky was blue. There were some cottony clouds here and there. And there was nothing. And then all of a sudden, pop, right out of the blue, came a beautiful, glowing craft, a light craft, as it's called, a plasma craft. And it was right over us. And then, boom, another. And then, boom, another. And then, boom, another. Five ships appeared. And it was unbelievably beautiful. And my wife is looking up at this, and she says, "The only thing I've ever heard," she says, "Oh, my God." So, you know, I'm like, at this point, I'm so excited. I can hardly contain myself. Tears are running down my face. I'm talking to them, and they're talking to me, and I can hear them. And as I do so, and I'm speaking aloud, my wife is hearing me, and I said, "Thank you for coming." And they all flashed at us, even brighter, like a flashbulb. And she says, "Look at that." And I said, so I spoke some more. And as I spoke, one or two or all would flash in response. Well, by my watch, they stayed and danced and did unbelievable maneuvers, left, right, up, down, in unbelievable speeds for 3 minutes and 40 seconds. At that point, they lined up and started to move to the north. And just like you would push peas out of a pod, one by one, they went pop, 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 and disappeared into the northern horizon. It was absolutely amazing. I was stunned beyond belief and excited. So we went to dinner, and I have to tell you, Jim, I never once touched the seat for the rest of the evening. I was floating that high. So it was an amazing event, and just one of many that we experienced here.
Well, I must say it is a fascinating account. I thank you for sharing it because it's a very personal thing. And at this time, there's nowhere necessarily for anybody to go and refer to your work. I mean, you don't currently have a blog or anything like that or a book. Am I correct in that?
I used to lecture. I used to travel all over. I have been to CITD and many conferences. As I said, I've been in the UFO field a long time, and a great number of people do know me or are aware of me. And I've investigated many, many famous cases, including Billy Meyer, who I used to correspond with. And he's probably one of the most famous UFO cases, and considering the Pleiadians that contacted him. But I fully believe I do not charge for my services. I am not interested in monetary gain. I'm not interested really in notoriety. But if that's what it takes to get the word out about other beings that are here to help us, then that's what I will do. There are many, many different avenues for people to pursue. There's a great, great number of videos available, of course, on YouTube, and a great, great number of them are pure garbage. I will tell you that. I've looked at thousands and thousands of videos, read tens of thousands of books. I have 10,000 books in my own library. not just on UFOs, of course. So there's lots and lots and lots of garbage information, and one must be quite discerning when digging through these things. But the information is there. It is amongst the rest of it. And so taking your time, looking for credible sources, and most importantly of all, not being afraid to talk to people or relate to people if you have had an unusual experience. In fact, I have taken to wearing a very special UFO amulet, pendant, if you will, on a chain. I wear it all the time. One, proudly, is basically who I am, but it's a great conversation starter, and I cannot tell you how many hundreds of people have approached me, seen what I was wearing, said, gee, that's really cool UFO, and before you know it, they're relating to me a story about something that has happened to them. And that gets them aware, able to talk, and come to the club and different avenues and so forth. And so one by one, if that's the way I have to do it, then that's the way I'll do it.
And I've got to guess if somebody really wanted to get in touch with you, they could probably contact the Cleveland Ufology Project. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. They can do that. They can also they can look me up. I'm on Facebook. I don't use it very often, believe it or not, but I am there. And a Cleveland Ufology Project, they can look up quite readily, contact me there. I don't even know to this point what other methods I would use. I'm still a throwback. I don't even use a smartphone. So
well, those two, I think those two would work just fine. It's one man's experience, and he's been kind enough to share it with us today. Dale Harder, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks so much. I hope that you enjoyed the Paranormal Podcast this week. It was nice to delve into a UFO show to start things off right for 2017. Next week, we're going to do something totally different. We're going to talk to Jody Levon, the Happy Medium, and she's going to tell us all about mediumship. Really a lively guest. I know that you will absolutely enjoy her, and we have more surprises on the way next week as well. We'll talk to you then. I hope you also check out The Campfire. Don't forget that. That's absolutely free if you've not had a chance to check out that podcast. Rate and review us on iTunes, and please tell a friend. And we'll talk to you next time on The Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.